I next met with Dr. Karen Gelman, and to begin, I asked her about research being done in her cancer center on the potential role of exercise during adjuvant chemotherapy.
I think exercise is a really important issue in terms of not just the survivorship issue after a diagnosis of breast cancer, but the whole question of during the treatment of breast cancer. So in Canada, one of the researchers, Carrie Carinia, in Edmonton got a grant, and we've done two randomized clinical trials in three different centers in Canada looking at exercising women during their adjuvant chemotherapy. And actually, we're doing another one right now. We're doing a third one that's just a unicenter, a single center trial. The first trial we did, the START trials, had a lot of publications, and we randomized women who were undergoing adjuvant chemotherapy to either receive no exercise or no prescribed exercise, or a prescription for an aerobic exercise, or a prescription for an aerobic and a resistance exercise program. And all of the women came into a specific gym 3 times a week, whether it was a chemo day or not, and exercised with one of the exercise physiologists or nurses at the time. The things that came out from that were mainly quality of life issues. Initially, that the women who were in the exercise group, and it didn't matter which exercise group, had less fatigue, better quality of life, felt more relaxed and less anxiety during their chemo. And what we began to think about it as is not just the exercise, but almost a support group, an active support group for women undergoing adjuvant chemotherapy. And this was pretty exciting. They also got more information. They got information from the other women exercising. They also got information from the nurse or the exercise physiologist, how to deal with their anxiety, how to deal with their nausea, about white count, all of those things that we as the oncologist see the patient for, but we see them just at the initiation of their chemo and before each cycle. So the information also seemed to improve quality of life and decreased anxiety. What's happened, though, is we've analyzed this study for a number of different features. We've looked at their psychological well-being. We've looked at their sleep, which was better. And most recently, we had a publication that looked at survival outcomes. And it's not statistically significant, but there's a trend that the groups who got exercise did better than the placebo or control group. So that's pretty exciting. It's, again, it wasn't a huge study. There were some 300 women in it. Could we have shown a benefit if we had done a larger study? Possibly. But I think it's not just the survival outcome that's important, but all of the ancillary measures around quality of life that were really important.
So about 2 weeks ago, for the first time, our CME group traveled to the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings. We did a seminar there, and one of the highlights in my mind was talking about PARP inhibitors. We had Ursula Matulonis from Dana-Farber there, and it was just really cool. And I know that's been an area you've been involved in breast cancer, and I'm just kind of curious where things stand today. It seems like a lot. We heard about a lot of really cool things in ovarian cancer. Where are we today with breast cancer?
So I'm pleased to say that we're starting to do some cool things in breast cancer as well. I think the PARP inhibitors have suffered from long delays in development. The first study in breast cancer that really showed an effect was the Andy Tutt study looking at patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutations and really showed a stunning effect. I then looked at triple negative cancers and a very, very small cohort of BRCA cancer patients. And we put in that small cohort just to have sort of a placeholder. Unfortunately, we didn't see a lot of resist level effect, although we saw some biological effect in the BRCA carriers. But it was a small cohort. And it unfortunately, I think, affected people to think negatively about PARP inhibitors. We did not see anything in the triple negative, which was not a total surprise, particularly as we now realize that triple negative is a big catch-all type of group, and we really had to select more carefully. What happened, I think, was PARP inhibitors went off on ovarian, and there were some exciting things happening, and PARP inhibitors really lay in abeyance in breast cancer.
And actually, I remember I was thinking about that presentation that you did. I think it was at ASCO a couple years ago, and yeah, I remember the ovarian part of your presentation because the thing that was so striking, and again, at SGO, it was so interesting, was that you were seeing responses in people who were not BRCA positive of ovarian, correct?
Exactly. And I think that's why it took off in ovarian. And it's really exciting because we know that a large number of patients with ovarian cancer acquired BRCA mutations or methylation issues, and they were responding. So that was pretty exciting. I think the thing that came out of my study that was a bit unfortunate in terms of ovarian was we started to identify that the group that's sensitive to PARP may be the same group that's sensitive to platinums and that they might be targeting the same sort of areas. That gets exciting in terms of combining them, however. So ovarian took off, and in breast, we sort of had a lack of interest by the companies really to develop. What's happened now is after a number of years of lots of people really advocating for PARP inhibitors in breast cancer, suddenly we're seeing some activity. There are a number of PARP inhibitors that are very much like olaparib, the first one that was reported by Dr. Tutte. There's a BioMarin inhibitor that's a slightly different mechanism. These have been compared in the lab, and all of them are now going into phase two studies in breast cancer, looking at randomizing patients with BRCA mutations, be it one or two, to either the PARP inhibitor or best standard of care. And I think we're going to suddenly get a lot of information about their role in metastatic. The other very exciting area that's happening is the Olympia study is opening up. The Olympia study is going to look at PARP inhibitors in the adjuvant setting. So what's going to happen is those patients with fairly high-risk BRCA mutation early breast cancer are going to be eligible to be randomized after their chemotherapy and radiation to either receive a PARP inhibitor or a placebo. And we'll start understanding if PARP inhibitors have an effect in decreasing recurrence rates in BRCA carriers with breast cancer. So there's some exciting stuff happening with PARP inhibitors. I think it's going to be a long time before we understand if there's a role for PARP inhibitors in non-BRCA mutation carriers in breast cancer, but that's part of our whole dissection of the different subtypes of breast cancer.
Do you think that there are enough patients who have BRCA mutations to do studies, to have companies get involved? It seems like it's a pretty tiny number.
So that's a very good question. So I have some of those concerns. I think the large number of metastatic studies may be a mistake, and we may be wanting to coalesce and just do a couple of them, and that's been talked about. I think if we have an international consortium, which we do for the Olympia study, I think we've got enough patients. There is also a pre-Olympia that's being discussed, and personally, I think the Olympia should be prioritized because it's been on the books for longer and it makes more sense first and get that done, because I think your concern is a valid concern. The other thing around these studies is more and more BRCA patients hopefully will be identified early and not have very high-risk cancers when they're diagnosed, and therefore not even be at a very high risk of relapse.
Dr. Madelon has presented patients with, you know, CAT scans where things shrunk, who, you know, people who didn't have BRCA mutations. Are there any patients like that with breast cancer other than BRCA patients?
Well, I think that's a huge question. So one of my colleagues, Sam Aparicio, has sequenced close to 100 breast cancer patients with triple negative cancers. And certainly the ubiquitous marker there is P53. It's not something like BRCA. There are a small number of patients with BRCA mutations, and the majority of those are germline mutations. But there are a few patients with BRCA-like cancers that aren't germline. So I think when you look at the triple negative landscape, there might be a very, very small number that would fit in there. I think it's quite different than the breast cancer. The other question, however, is we're understanding more and more about clonal evolution. And one of the problems with the breast cancer studies to date have been that they've looked at the primary tumors basically in terms of deciphering triple negatives. It may be that there's a group with a clonal evolution who might start as basal or something, but develop BRCA mutations, and we're not identifying them yet because we're not doing those studies. We're starting to understand the heterogeneity of triple negative disease and that some have longer survival than others. And I think it behooves us to start looking at those over serial testing to see if they develop, similar to ovarian, some targeting of BRCA. That might be done by serial sequencing of the tumors by biopsying. It might be done by circulating tumor DNA. I mean, I think we're getting the tools now to do that, so we have to do it. And until we do it, it's not probably correct to be giving PARP inhibitors to triple negatives until we identify if there's a group that might be sensitive.
You know, one pretty prominent presentation involving a PARP inhibitor was given by Hope Rugo from the iSpy initiative at San Antonio. And she reported on the combination of carboplatin, I believe it was a platinum, with veliparib. And, you know, it kind of, to my eyes, seemed like it was, higher PCR rate. You know, there was something there, but it wasn't completely clear, why. Was it the PARP inhibitor or the platinum or both? Any thoughts about that data set?
Well, I think that's an interesting data set. And I think the iSpy clinical trial design is an excellent one to be testing these. The problem is, though, that we've all gotten burnt with small studies or even with randomized phase twos. So, I think we don't know quite yet. Certainly, platinums in the neoadjuvant setting are looking better and better. And whether the veliparib really made a difference or not, I think we don't know. It looked interesting. But remember the aniparib story, and I don't think we want to get back into that. So I think that hypothesis generating interesting are the right adjectives. To make more of it at this point would be probably a mistake.
You mentioned the issue of platinums neoadjuvantly in triple negative disease. And also at San Antonio, we saw the CALGB study that, again, showed a modest increase in path CR rate. Any thoughts about that study and what you're doing in your own practice? Are there any times that you use platinums neoadjuvantly, for example, younger patient with a big triple negative tumor?
Neil, I think that's a huge question. And we've got the German data, we've got CILGB data, we've got some other data. All of it is neoadjuvant. All of it is around PCR. There's certainly a suggestion that the addition of platinums is of benefit. My concern is, again, across the board, which group is it? When you look at that study that MD Anderson presented last year at ASCO using the Lehmann classification for triple negative cancers and looking at PCR rate, certainly the basal one in that classification had a better PCR rate. And I'm kind of curious to know, is it the basal ones that we're going to get another incremental improvement, or is it another group from that kind of classification? In my practice at this point of time, I have started occasionally adding platinums, but I work in a place where guidelines are the be-all and end-all, and it hasn't been put into the official guidelines yet, although we're discussing it a lot. I think one of the places where I hear it creeping is in the adjuvant setting, and we really don't have any data in the adjuvant setting yet. There are a lot of people saying we really have to do those studies. There are people from ECOG who have put forward a proposition. We at NCIC have put forward a proposition to do that. I think we need to do it. You know, the problem is people are saying, do we already know the answer? Or is this the most important question? And the other problem is funding of platinums. Who's going to fund a platinum? Finally, you look at all the other tumor types. Is it carbo or is it cis? You know, those arguments continue to rage in ovarian, in testicular, in lung, in other sites. And I don't know that we know whether it should be cis or carbo. Old data from phase two trials, which were done in unselected patients, which suggests cis platinums got more legs in breast cancer. Some preclinical data that's come out of a variety of labs, including Mark Pegram's, would suggest that cis is better. But generally, a number of the trials have been done with carbo. So I also don't know we know which platinum we should be using.
So another new strategy I wanted your thoughts on. I saw that you have one of these trials in progress from San Antonio, a phase three study. I like this name, the Penelope study, with the CDK inhibitor that I can never pronounce, palbociclib. And obviously, that's a really fascinating story. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that agent. I saw some kind of press release or something that something was presented, but I'm not sure if that was new or not. It said Richard Finn, so I figured it was the old thing. But anyhow, what's up with that?
So palbociclib, I have trouble pronouncing it as well. Why don't we call it palbo? So I think the whole area with CDK inhibitors is exciting. And palbo is in clinical development. There are other drugs that are in clinical development, so Palbo's not the only one. We were involved in a phase 2 trial that randomized postmenopausal women with ER-positive cancers that were advanced to receive either letrozole or letrozole plus Palbo. That trial was first presented almost 2 years ago at the IMPACT meeting by Rich Finn, and the initial cohort, the first cohort, showed a remarkable improvement in progression-free survival for the addition of Palbo to letrozole. The second cohort they did looked at a group where they tried to select. It's not clear what the target is. The RB gene was thought to be the target. And with the select group, they didn't do much better. That study has since been presented a number of times and continues to show a very exciting difference in progression-free survival. And Rich Finn just presented it yesterday at the AACR meeting. So this is a randomized phase 2.
But it's still the same study.
It's the same study, but the update, and I can tell you the update, is the update for progression-free survival for the letrozole arm, and remember this is first-line hormonal, it was about 10 months. The update for the Palbo plus letrozole was 20 months. That was a doubling, and 20-month progression-free survival for a group of endocrine-sensitive patients is pretty exciting. The overall survival was presented by Rich as well, and it did not show a statistically significant difference, although there was a 4-month difference. So there was a 4-month difference, but it was not statistically significant. So what's happening with that drug? This was only a phase 2. There's a large phase 3 happening. They've randomized about 450 patients so far out of a total of 650. Same design in terms of drug Palbo plus letrozole versus letrozole, with a few caveats. First of all, there's a lot more safety stuff going on. So there's safety around how should it be given. With all of these drugs, there's concern about heart and other issues. With Palbo, the major findings have been a slight decrease in white count that's not been associated with infection, but has to be watched. The second thing with the Palbo is they're looking at giving it with food or not, because again, as you use a drug more, you understand the pharmacokinetics. So that's being done. Can you use it with proton inhibitors? You know, a number of different things that are of practical significance. So that trial is enrolling well. It'll be a year or 2 years before we get results. But in the meantime, there's two other trials that are happening with this drug that are exciting. One is a drug that's led by Günter von Minkowitz, the Penelope trial, as you mentioned. It's looking at neoadjuvant chemotherapy in ER-positive patients. So a lot of ER-positive patients, we don't give neoadjuvant chemo, but some high risk, we do give neoadjuvant chemo. And we know that their path CR rate isn't great. So what is happening in this trial is for those patients who did not have a path CR, who have HER2 normal ER-positive cancers, they're eligible to be enrolled in either getting Palbo plus letrozole or tamoxifen, or just the letrozole or tamoxifen, to see if outcomes can be different. The other trial that's going to be starting, probably not for at least 6 months, is the PALLAS trial, P-A-L-L-A-S, not in terms of a king palace, but a different palace. And that trial is going to be run internationally, both by BIG in Europe and by the Alliance Foundation in the U.S. and Canada. And it's going to look at the adjuvant use of Palbo plus letrozole versus letrozole. So there's a lot of activity happening. Again, I don't think we know yet which are the group of patients that benefit most. We might learn it from the phase 3 trial that's happening right now, because blocks are being collected on that trial.
Interesting. I see that you have a case here of a patient who had ER-positive breast cancer with progression. I'd be curious to know sort of what the story was there, because maybe just sort of leaning into that, is any sort of thoughts or hypotheses about why people, I know it's kind of a basic question, but why people develop resistance to endocrine therapy? I heard some stuff about, mutations in estrogen receptors. And to me, it's always been kind of weird, like why people, even in prostate, why, retain the receptors, you see responses, and yet they're resistant to an agent. How do you sort of conceptualize what's going on?
So I think that that's a huge question, and certainly there are patients who developed endocrine resistance. Recently, there have been some definitions developed around endocrine resistance, and I think using those definitions is important in terms of trying to talk about the same cohorts rather than talk about apples and oranges. We see those patients who develop resistance very soon. So the definition would be progression on an endocrine agent within 2 years of adjuvant, so like during their first 2 years of adjuvant, or no response to endocrine agents. And those are really primary resistance. The other group, which is far more common, is the secondary resistance, who progress after greater than 2 years of adjuvant endocrine therapy or after the completion of endocrine therapy adjuvantly, or who develop a response but then progress. There have been a lot of theories around what's happening. One of the theories that was there for a long time and still may be present is the question of activation of the HER families, be it EGFR1, HER2, HER3, one of those. And there have been a number of studies along the way looking at combining an EGFR inhibitor such as gefitinib or erlotinib plus endocrine agents. There have been studies looking at combining HER2 agents like lapatinib or neratinib and endocrine agents. These studies have shown some efficacy, but really have not had the home run we wanted, nor have they totally defined yet a population that we can see. More recently, there have been descriptions, and this was just last fall, there were descriptions of ESR1 mutations. So ESR1 is the estrogen receptor, and mutations and a number of different mutations in the ESR1. There were two publications last fall that comprised a total of 80 different samples of patients with endocrine resistance. And what was interesting is 14 out of the 80 had ESR1 mutations. None of the mutations were seen in the primary tumor. They were all only seen in the biopsied metastases. So what does this tell us? This talks about what we're now understanding, this clonal evolution theory, that tumors develop resistance mechanisms. It's not necessarily there in the primary tumor. And it gets back to what we were talking about a little bit with triple negative, that you really have to look at the metastases to start understanding this. We've actually been sequencing a lot of estrogen receptor positive cancers. We're sitting down and looking at those and showing that we are actually seeing more ESR1 mutations than has been described, possibly because we're biopsying these women later and later in their endocrine career. So we don't understand why these occur. We certainly don't yet understand how to target them. But I think this is the most exciting thing that's come up in terms of understanding endocrine resistance in the last while, because it's there and it's something to start defining. I think the questions we need our basic and translational scientists to help us with in the clinic is, when do these occur? Is there a certain phenotype where they occur? And most importantly, how can we stop them from occurring, or how can we target them once they occur? It certainly looks like those patients don't respond to classic endocrine agents. Whether they'll respond to something like palbo or not is a question, though, and I don't think we know yet. So it's going to be really important that we do serial biopsies and that we do it in a collaborative international way to pick up these mutations.
I've been asking lung cancer investigators for a long time how they determine when a mutation is a driver mutation. I'm still not sure I understand the answer, but these mutations that are found in estrogen receptor, are they thought to be driver mutations?
Yes, they are. I mean, I think that's the other thing. You know, we're all getting more and more interested in looking at mutations, but the whole other part of the omics we're sort of not looking at, you know, which are the drivers, which really reflect protein synthesis and all of the other parts of the pathways. It does look like these ESR1 may be driver mutations, and certainly that's the thought. Again, we're just going to need a lot more trials to look at these.
It's interesting, though, because, you know, now we're starting to hear, again, in lung, of agents being specifically developed to focus on the mutations. For example, EGFR mutations, initially erlotinib and gefitinib, et cetera. But now there's this third generation that supposedly just targets the mutant EGFR. And I don't know, maybe is that kind of strategy going to be applied in breast cancer?
I think it will be. I think the interesting things that are coming along is, number one, the drugs that will target just the mutation and maybe turn off the mutation, rendering somebody endocrine sensitive again so that you can even recycle an endocrine agent. The second thing is, how are we going to diagnose those? And one of the most interesting things to come along right now is circulating tumor DNA can we use a liquid biopsy to really identify these women earlier so we don't have to serially biopsy? And the third thing is going to be maybe even using functional imaging. Can we use a functional imaging PET scanner with a tracer that will pick these up, that will identify those things? Finally, I think the other thing I'm learning as I grow older with this experience is that tumors are more heterogeneous than we expected, and sometimes we get asynchronous responses. So what we might want to do is, if we see that one part of the metastases is developing the ESR1 mutations and others aren't, is it might be that we'll be looking at more cocktails of treatments in order to target all these different areas of the tumor.
Or maybe we'll forget the whole targeted therapy thing and be doing immune therapy in 5 years. I don't know.
Exactly. Well, that's a whole other area.
Anyhow, why don't we talk a little bit about your cases, beginning with this patient with ER-positive disease?
So I wanted to talk about a woman that is in my practice right now. She's a young woman. She's postmenopausal now, but she was young when she got diagnosed. She got diagnosed when she was about 44, so that's fairly young. She had a ER-positive, PR-positive, HER2-negative cancer that was a fairly good size. Her tumor was about 4 centimeters when she got diagnosed. She had 2 out of about 4 nodes positive with some extranodal extension. She was treated initially with FEC docetaxel, one of the regimens that was used. I didn't see her at that time. So it had been 3 cycles of 5-FU epirubicin cyclophosphamide, and then followed by 3 cycles of docetaxel. She had radiation to her breast and nodal areas, and then she was put on tamoxifen because she was premenopausal at the start. She had an offer. She did become postmenopausal with her chemo, and she had an offer of switching her strategy about 2 years into it, but she was working on a PhD thesis, said she didn't really want to change. She was doing well. She didn't want to risk new treatments. And she continued on tamoxifen at about 4.5 years of tamoxifen, so just near the end of her first 5 years, which I think many of us would talk about longer treatment with a node-positive premenopausal woman now, both with the ATLAS and ATOM results as well as with results like MA17 with aromatase inhibitors. But just at about 4.5 years, she developed some backache. She, of course, being a person who didn't want to think about breast cancer, initially went to her chiropractor, did a number of things like that, but did eventually circle back to her oncologist, who she was due to see, and was diagnosed with bony metastases at that time. And that's actually when I met her. She came to see me at that time with bony metastases. We did staging, and the only thing we found other than the bony metastases was a small node in her supraclavicular area on her affected side. And we rebiopsied that, which has become pretty standard in my practice to rebiopsy at the time of metastatic disease. And when we rebiopsied, it was exactly the same, an ER-positive, PR-positive, HER2-negative cancer, so it hadn't changed at all. She was put on letrozole at that point and has done remarkably well with letrozole. She was also put on a bisphosphonate, and her disease in her neck melted away, her bony pain went away, her disease really responded well, and she's had a really good run. She's had about 22 months with the letrozole alone, and has tolerated it very well. She then came in about 2 months ago to see me, and she has progressive disease in her bones. She's also got just a suggestion of some enlarging nodes in her chest, nothing to palpate, but some enlarging nodes in her chest, which are suggestive of progressive nodal disease. So she still only has nodal disease and bony disease that's confirmed. There's a tiny little 7-millimeter suspicious lesion in her liver, but it's not confirmed, and it's really too small to stick a needle in very safely, nor does she want one. So I think she presents as a case where certainly we see a lot of these patients with long times on hormonal agents and what's the next treatment. The treatments that, you know, now that I'm seeing her with progression on letrozole and really a good run on letrozole, I would be entertaining would be, first of all, a clinical trial, obviously, which is there. And I did offer a clinical trial, but Outside of clinical trials, I think the two big groups that I would look at would be fulvestrant, and fulvestrant is certainly there as an option. Or do I put her on the combination of exemestane and everolimus, which is the other big area? And I think that many people looking after breast cancers are coming up against this over and over again. We do have some evidence from fulvestrant that we may be closer to the right dose, that 500 milligrams every 4 weeks is probably the right dose, although there are even suggestions from some researchers that a higher dose might be better. We have the CONFIRM trial that showed a positive hazard ratio and a 20% improvement of fulvestrant against itself for the higher dose, which was interesting. We have other trials looking at fulvestrant versus an aromatase inhibitor, and we actually have the FALCON trial that's going on right now in first line that is comparing anastrozole to fulvestrant at this higher dose. We don't have any results. Benefits, I think, of fulvestrant are that it's very well tolerated. It's only an IM injection once a month. And most patients do very well. Benefit for this woman is that she really has done well with endocrine therapy. On the other hand, we have the option of exemestane and everolimus. And exemestane and everolimus is certainly an exciting combination. We know from the Bolero 2 trial that there was a significant difference in progression-free survival with about a four-month difference in progression-free survival, or almost a four-month, 3 to 4 month difference in progression-free survival. So that certainly is effective. At the European Breast Meeting in Glasgow last month, Martine Picard presented the overall survival for Bolero 2 and did not show a statistically significant difference, but I'm not sure that that was not too high a hurdle. The difference in overall survival, although it didn't reach statistical significance, was the same as a progression-free survival. So I think that difference in progression is real. And we know that exemestane and everolimus is variably tolerated. Some women tolerate it beautifully. Some women get weariness. Some women get mouth sores. So I think this case is an interesting case that brings up a dilemma that we are often facing with our patients. We don't have the randomized data to tell us which order to give endocrine agents. We don't have the data that would tell us whether giving fulvestrant or exemestane everolimus is better in this woman. And I think this is one of the places where it really becomes a long discussion with the patient, a discussion around side effects, a discussion around patient preference.
So, you know, for years we ask people poll questions and surveys to try to figure out, you know, what, you know, as you were presenting this case, I was clicking off in my mind if we had put this in a survey. And I'm going to bet that you gave her fulvestrant. Wrong or right?
I did give her fulvestrant for a few reasons,
But I'm also going to bet that if I changed that case and had her progress after 8 months of receiving letrozole, maybe you would have gone to everolimus and exemestane.
Well, I think that you've got a point. I think that right now we don't really understand which group benefits from everolimus and exemestane. Some people are suggesting it's the people further along, and I think we're going to see soon whether the ESR1 mutations are those patients. Other people are saying, well, it works in the neoadjuvant setting. It doesn't have to be earlier. And when you look at the Bolero 2 data, whether it was first line or second line, it didn't really make a huge difference. So I think you're right. I think earlier progression, we might have used the exemestane everolimus more, but I don't know that we have the data for that. I think what we do know is that potentially the side effects are a bit better on fulvestrant than on exemestane everolimus. So sometimes we go on that, and if we think it's a more aggressive disease, we'll say, don't worry as much about side effects. So you're quite right. What I was going to say is this woman definitely chose the fulvestrant, and I put her on fulvestrant. However, I had a woman almost identical who came shortly after her who chose the exemestane everolimus because she didn't like needles and she didn't want an IM injection once a month. So I think this is really where our art of clinical oncology comes in, where we have to work with the patient to see what their choices are.
Yeah, I'm just kind of like, I just watch and see what people do and see if I can predict what they do. And there always has been so much emphasis on toxicity with everolimus, which, you know, I totally understand, but those hazard rates also were pretty good.
The hazard rates are great. And I have to say that in my experience, I have a lot of patients who just sail through it. I have other patients who start at the 10 milligrams and I put them down to 5 milligrams and they feel fine. So I think the toxicity is there, but it's not as great. I have, however, seen some pulmonary toxicity, and I think we have to keep remembering the pulmonary toxicity. We have to see these patients at 4 weeks and then every 6 weeks or so. We can't use just our usual algorithm for endocrine therapy. The other thing I've seen, and I've recently seen it, is some patients who have diabetes get really out of control sugars and have difficulty with that. Again, I've had some patients who have added or topped up their dose of their oral antiglycemics and have done very well, and I've had other patients with troubles. So I think we're aware of the toxicity, but it's certainly manageable.
Yeah, I haven't heard very much about pulmonary toxicity in breast cancer. I heard more about it with renal cell. Have you actually seen patients with symptomatic pulmonary toxicity?
I have. So we did the randomized study of weekly versus daily. We might be a bit more sensitized to it, but I have seen two patients with early toxicity with the daily.
So let's talk about your 42-year-old lady.
So I want to talk about a 42-year-old woman who had a ER-negative, PR-negative, HER2-positive breast cancer. She had one node positive and a T2 tumor. It was a very typical HER2-positive case. She was treated with dose-dense AC followed by Taxol trastuzumab, probably the most standard treatment that's used internationally for HER2-positive cases, tolerated it beautifully, completed her year of trastuzumab in September of 2012. She came for a follow-up appointment in the end of October of 2012 and complained about pain in her scapular area, very nonspecific pain. She worked as a nursing practitioner, and when she was really lifting patients, she noticed it. She didn't notice it otherwise. She didn't notice it lying down or turning over or when she was doing her chores at home. She really thought that it was a work-related strain. She wanted to go to physio first, but a bone scan was ordered, which was negative. And she went to physio, and she presented about a month later with persistence of this pain and a slightly more radicular nature to the pain coming around her right side. At that point, blood work was done, which showed elevation of some of her liver enzymes, her gamma GT and her ALK-FOS, and a liver scan revealed numerous liver metastases. So this is occurring only about 2 months after the completion of her trastuzumab, and certainly her pain had come on near the end of her adjuvant trastuzumab. A biopsy was done of her liver, which revealed that this was still estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and HER2 positive cancer. This woman was actually put on a trial of afatinib plus vinorelbine, afatinib being a oral TKI, and she did very well getting a good response, but the trial was stopped. So she, after about 3 months of getting a good response, was unable to continue on that drug, and her oncologist of the time put her on trastuzumab and vinorelbine. She didn't want to lose her hair again. She was doing well on the vinorelbine, and trastuzumab and vinorelbine seemed like the right thing for her to be on. But unfortunately, she progressed very quickly on the trastuzumab and vinorelbine. She was then progressing and was able to enroll on a T-DM1 trial and started receiving T-DM1 in July of 2013. So typical patient, one would expect to do well on T-DM1. Now she wouldn't need to get it on trial, but at the time it was not approved and she needed to get it on trial. So she was an estrogen negative, progesterone negative, HER2 positive patient with liver metastases only. She unfortunately did not get a response with the T-DM1. And in fact, after two cycles of T-DM1, had progressive disease. So I think this creates a dilemma. we get new drugs. We think these new drugs should be the answer to everything. And the question is, what do we do now? What's interesting about this patient is I have two patients with almost identical stories who got to this point. This patient, we went and re-biopsied her liver at that point because the question came out, TDM1 being such a targeted agent, was she really HER2 positive? And of interest, this patient really was HER2 positive, still had exactly the same biomarkers with the ERPR negative and the HER2 positive. And at that point, I put her on lapatinib and capecitabine. So even though we have trials like ME31 suggesting lapatinib may be less active, or Amelia suggesting lapatinib capecitabine might be less active than TDM1, we also know the heterogeneity of the disease. This woman has had a brilliant response to lapatinib capecitabine.
Wow.
She has been to the Philippines with her son twice since last summer to visit her aging and unwell father. I just saw her in the clinic last week, and her liver lesions have almost completely resolved. She feels well. She's needed some dose reductions because she does have a lot of hand-foot toxicity, but she's tolerating the drug. And this is, to me, a case that's very important for us to always look at the individual, that just because clinical trial results may say one is better than the other, it doesn't mean that there are no responses with the other one, and that we have to look at every case individually. This is obviously a tragic case as well because she does have what appears to be a real primary resistance to trastuzumab. And when she progresses on the lapatinib capecitabine, you know, I'm not sure where I'll go at that point of time. But I think this is a good example of looking at each patient individually.
That's a great case. Capecitabine is good stuff, huh?
Yeah, capecitabine is an amazing
drug. Just kidding. Who knows? Maybe that's the whole reason she's responding. I don't know. But I mean, any postulations on why the tumor would respond to, let's say it's the lapatinib, who knows, but this combination?
So I don't think we know. People have looked at P95, people have looked at ligands, people have looked at a lot of things. We are doing a study right now where we're sequencing a number of patients who have long, long responses to metastatic treatment with trastuzumab versus those that have either no response or very short response. And this woman's tumor is being sequenced, both her primary and her met. So we might learn something.
Okay, I have a theory. Maybe she's got a HER2 mutation, because I remember the lung people, because you see these HER2 mutations in lung cancer. For some reason, they've been saying, well, the TKI should do better with this. And I don't really know why, but would that make any sense?
So we do know that there are HER2 mutations, and some of those HER2 mutations occur in who we would classically say are HER2 negative. There's a study going on right now that's being led by WashU, and there's another study starting up in Europe looking at neratinib in those patients with HER2 mutations. And I think that's an interesting question. Does this woman have a HER2 mutation? I'll let you know when I find out, because we're sequencing her tumor and we might know. To just mention the other case that I had that was very similar to this, when we re-biopsied her tumor, it turned out that her tumor was HER2 negative. And what's interesting is we've gone back on that woman. Her initial core biopsy was HER2 positive, but we went back and looked at her surgical specimen, which was HER2 negative, and we've looked at both of her metastatic lesions, which are HER2 negative. Although I think we treat with anti-HER2 therapy if we see HER2 at any time, this second case that I had that was very similar to this case, I'm now not treating with her any anti-HER2 therapy because she obviously is not responding.
So when you went back to the primary, it was HER2 negative?
Yeah, only the core was positive.
Do you think this was a heterogeneity or lab issues?
I suspect it's heterogeneity and that she responded to the adjuvant trastuzumab very well, and a clone that was HER2 negative is what's metastasized.